Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "One's mind, once stretched by a new experience, can never go back to its old dimensions." In this podcast, we are proud to present our guests, the world leaders and pioneers in the fields of neurointerventional surgery, interventional radiology, and endovascular neurosurgery. We will bring you through their personal journey and the three cases that have marked their professional career. From the very first to the very last case, passing by the most enriching and challenging, welcome to this original format by Link Online, my first, my last, my everything. Hi everyone, my name is Nantia Sujichantararat, and today I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Adam Arthur. Dr. Arthur is the Chair of Neurosurgery at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center and the Semmes Murphey Clinic. Hi, Dr. Arthur.
Hello.
We usually start from the very beginning. So could you tell us a little bit about your path leading to this point in your career?
I got into medicine because I thought that helping people and having that as a focus in my life would help me to live a better life, selfishly. And I got into neurosurgery because restoring, preserving, and aiding in allowing people to have neurologic function seems to be so much better than worrying about the gastrointestinal system or hematological system or other systems in the body. As far as this point in my career within neurosurgery, I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about how to help other neurosurgeons to be better than I am and teaching them, and what sorts of clinical research will help us to better understand what works and what doesn't work as we do this work.
Who inspired you to go into endovascular neurosurgery, just out of curiosity? Who's your source of inspiration and mentor?
Several. Nick Hopkins, very early in my career, was exceedingly kind to me. In my generation, that's true of so many of us. I didn't do my fellowship with him, but I don't think I'd be here without him. My fellowship mentor was a radiologist named John Barr, and John really taught me to be very careful and meticulous, to get in and get out, leaving nothing changed other than what you wanted to change, and to be very precise about endovascular technique. John's also someone who's very honest and very careful about talking to patients and their families, which is another important component of doing this well.
For someone who just started out, what advice do you have for the fellows or junior attendings?
One of the things I tell my fellows is that balance isn't a noun, it's a verb. When you use it as a noun, it connotes a certain degree of effortless grace, and it doesn't feel like that to me. It feels like a constant struggle between polarities that pull you in one direction or another. So I think recentering yourself, asking yourself if you should be doing something or whether you've gone too far, correcting yourself, you know, trying to avoid becoming a baby-faced assassin who can engage with morbidity and mortality without any compunction or conscience versus being a blubbering mess who can't be effective because you're hurt by what you've done to somebody. I think the best surgeons and the best interventional radiologists, neurologists, whatever, are able to correct themselves constantly and try to steer that middle course to come back to the center of what we do.
What are some things that your fellows would say are complete Arthurism?
So I'm fairly stubborn about trying to make some decisions for what you would recommend to a patient before you engage with them on that question. I think that in the clinic, we're often dealing with hypotheticals. Would an aneurysm be safer to treat endovascularly open, or should it be left alone? And I think the lazy temptation of not really making up your mind, given the data you have, or having some structure to how that decision would be made, is dangerous. Patients don't come to us for a menu of options. They come because they want the best advice and care they can get. And I think that requires and demands that we really come to a strong decision and then offer that to them. Now, that doesn't mean that you're acting parentally and telling them what they should do without them having a role in it. It just means that you clearly communicate what the concerns are, what the problem is, what the options are, and what option you would choose were it your decision, what you recommend, and why. I think when a fellow tells me, well, we have option A, we have option B, we have option C, I often press them to make a decision. I press myself to make a decision so that you're able, I think, to be a better guide and physician for a patient.
Such a good point. You are clearly now on here because you're very successful in your career. You're one of the thought leaders and the influencers of the field. What was the process like getting here? Now you're national PIs on so many trials. You have been involved in many pivotal studies. What is the process of getting here?
Early in my career, I was told by many different people that I couldn't be a good open microneurosurgeon and also an interventionalist, that I had to pick one of the two, and I didn't like that. And so very early in my career, I did as many cases as I could, both of open and endovascular neurosurgery. I would characterize my early career phase as being sort of a case hound. You know, I spent a lot of time in the hospital. One of my mentors used to joke that the first space in the doctor's lot had my name on it because my car was there all the time. And then I had had an interest in clinical research for a long time, but, you know, it sometimes feels like a good old boys network that it's hard to break into. I wasn't given much opportunity to lead clinical trials or be involved in clinical research for whatever reason for a long time. But again, I'm pretty stubborn. And so I would show up with something that I thought I'd learned or something that I thought was interesting and give a presentation and try to do the best I could with the material I had. And I think that persistence in the end, as well as the attempt to continue to communicate well, eventually gave me opportunities that I could take sequentially that would lead to, you know, better opportunities. So I think stubbornness, doing the best with what you have, trying to be perceptive of what opportunities exist rather than to force what you think you should be doing into reality are important parts of developing a career.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the trials that you're involved in and the future direction that you see our field is moving to?
Sure. Endovascular approaches allow you to get to tissue the way that your body gets to tissue. So whether it's through an artery or a vein, you're allowed access in a way that I think is sometimes more organic, less invasive. And so I see our field developing where we're treating more disease states. So I'm excited about the potential to investigate and learn about whether endovascular approaches to the treatment of chronic subdural hematoma will be successful. It's crazy, but even 3 to 5 years ago, that was something that most places were not doing. And now, without the trials being done, that's become de rigueur. It's become standard in some ways. We move so quickly. So I'm helping to lead a study on the use of SQID to treat middle meningeal approaches to chronic subdurals that is a randomized controlled trial. And that's exciting, because RCTs are difficult and rare in our space. Less systemic anti-aggregation, I think, is important. We're dealing with an aging population, and there are reasons why it seems silly sometimes to completely affect someone's hematological system rather than locally affecting it. So the ELEVATE trial, looking at whether it would be possible to limit anti-aggregation in ruptured aneurysms treated with flow diversion, is another trial that we've just started. Your center enrolled the first patient. Thank you. Looking at iterations in flow diversion, we're looking at an expansion of indication for the Evolve Surpass flow diverting stent in the Evolve trial. I think that's another important trial. But all of these, I think, are sort of steps in understanding what the balance between risks and benefits of various new therapies are.
Do you have any advice for someone who's new to the space, who is trying to find their way of working with the industry? Obviously, in our field, industry is very important force and a partner in moving the field forward. Do you have any advice in how someone can do that coming out in a meaningful way, an ethical way?
Yes, much of what we do can't be done without industry. We're a technologically dependent field. I think the potential for industry-supported education and industry-supported research is fantastic. So availing yourself of those opportunities is only natural. Having said that, we have, I'd say, a mission or a calling or a sacred duty to really try to make sure that what we're doing is in the service of improving patient care. The nice thing is, the vast majority of my interactions with industry, they're very respectful of that. If you work in the neurointerventional field, you want to improve patient care. You have an opportunity to contribute to helping people to be with their family and live their lives better. But as a physician, you have an obligation to make sure things are framed in the right way, to make sure that words aren't put into your mouth or educational efforts, research efforts aren't corrupted to really only be marketing or commercial. I think it can backslide into that, not through any nefarious motives on the part of your industry partners, but you have a role. You have a role as a physician in sort of keeping that focus and drawing those lines. And so I think taking up that role and relishing that role is something that most people in industry want you to do. So don't be afraid to do it.
And now we'll go through the three questions about your cases. So the first one is, what is your first case as an attending neurosurgeon?
So I ended up doing fellowship in Memphis partly because I wanted to learn neuroendovascular techniques from an interventional neuroradiologist who had good skills and would teach me in a high-volume environment. I think both mentorship and volume of cases are sort of the flour and water of making, the bread. You're not going to be able to do it without those things. But while I was a neurointerventional fellow, I was given the opportunity to also be an open vascular attending neurosurgeon. I had two mentors on the open side, a man named Clarence Wattridge and another man named Morris Ray, and they were extraordinarily experienced cerebrovascular neurosurgeons. So the first sort of attending neurosurgeon open vascular case I did was clipping of a ruptured posterior communicating artery aneurysm. And so I remember that case. I remember worrying about whether I needed to drill off the clinoid or not, and eventually deciding not to drill off the clinoid, going through the steps of the case, getting control, the approach to even the muscle, the terionyl approach that I'd learned from Bill Caldwell and others at the University of Utah being a little bit different than what they were used to doing in Tennessee, and the feeling of just exultation when your patient wakes up and can move everything and looks like they're okay. So that's one that I won't soon forget.
Now we'll continue with the most interesting, most career-changing, or just the most memorable case that you can think of in your career, in any direction you want to go to.
So I met this nice old guy in his 70s who wore a cowboy hat, been married to the same woman for 50 years. And he had dizziness, headaches, an unstable gait, and a rather unscrupulous cardiologist had given him coronary stents for these problems, which, not unsurprisingly, had no effect on his symptoms. What he had was a giant mid-basilar, lower-basilar fusiform aneurysm that was growing and causing both hydrocephalus and brainstem compression. And this was early in our experience with flow diversion, and by our, I mean the field's. So I sent the case out to seven different people who were mentors to me in flow diversion, Kim Nelson, Pedro Lilic, a number of others. I got, I think, six different answers for what I should do for the guy. But I formulated a plan where we did an endoscopic third ventriculostomy because he had some hydrocephalus, and then treated him with a single flow diverter. Notably, Kim's approach was seven or eight flow diverters, but there were perforators right near the aneurysm, and I was worried about those. I was very pleased with how he did, but I'd spent a fair amount of time with him and his wife. He was a very confident guy. He joked all the time. I think he and his wife had a very solid relationship, but he told me he wasn't worried because he knew he would die being shot by a jealous husband, because he acted like he was cheating all the time, and I don't think he was. The case technically went fantastically, and he did well, and he went home. But we'd had a lot of discussion about the risks of the procedure, and about a week after the procedure, he died in his sleep from a massive rupture of the aneurysm. And before the paramedics had arrived to his house, his wife called me on my cell phone and told me what had happened and told me that they'd discussed this and they wanted an autopsy. They wanted me to try and learn from it. And so my fellows and I did an autopsy and discovered that the aneurysm had ripped in a very unusual way, linearly on the other side of the artery. I described it as like a fat guy's pants. I mean, it was almost like a seam had come apart. And up to that point, the major theory on why an aneurysm would rupture after flow diversion was inflammatory changes and destabilization of the wall. There was a paper out by the Buffalo group on this. But histologically, there were no macrophages. There was nothing to suggest inflammation. And so we presented and eventually published a very simple case report basically on what had happened to this guy who I really liked, and what his brain looked like with the hemorrhage there, what his aneurysm looked like. And I presented it at ABC Wynn in Val d'Isère. ABC Wynn was a frightening meeting for a young neurosurgeon in particular, because the entire first few rows were giants in interventional neuroradiology. And if you weren't careful, you might get just skewered in front of everybody. But there was a good reaction to it. There was something to learn there.
And just to clarify, the wall that you saw was ripped, was like proximal or distal wall?
It was the distal wall. It's not a saccular aneurysm. It's a fusiform aneurysm, but it was as far away from the parent artery as you could get. Mm-hmm. And so our theory was that it's really just mechanical stretch. Mm-hmm. That, you know, when you look at aneurysms that have been coiled in the operating room, the aneurysm has shrunk down and the coils are in the subarachnoid space. So I think what happens is that the aneurysm probably initially is stretched, just the way a wound heel is stretched. But it was so thin, I mean literally thinner than the membrane on an egg, that I think they probably often rip or stretch, but the clot or the clip or whatever prevents it from being a problem, which is why I think this complication's gone away largely, almost completely. It's because we're now coiling larger giant aneurysms with flow diversion. And so the aneurysms are still probably ripping, but the blood flow isn't able to get to the other side and bleed. Presenting that case led to the people who were running a company called Sequent asking me if I would be interested in leading their trial of the web device. Prior to that, I really couldn't get a shot at any kind of industry-funded research because I wasn't at an institution that was traditionally a thought leader within vascular neurosurgery. And that entrance sort of really changed things for me, and now I'm leading other trials and involved in industry-funded research. But it really was just kind of looking for opportunities, finding a dumb single thing that maybe was a point people hadn't come across, and trying to communicate it and being brave enough to communicate it in a situation where there's some risk. So that case, I think, really was fairly influential on my career. And I think about that guy and his wife not infrequently, because the relationship with him, the discussion with so many people about what we should do to try and treat him, the trust that he and his wife showed in me in allowing me to try and treat a very dangerous pathology. You know, I failed him, but we learned something out of it, and I think he completely understood the risks and the reasons why we were treating him the way we did, and then that was something that maybe helped other people, helped maybe in some small way, to change our approach to flow diversion for large and giant aneurysms.
Very challenging pathology. You are the second person that set that pathology for their most memorable case. So that just goes to show you how much equipoise there really is still around the giant aneurysm in the posterior circulation. So now for the final case, could you walk us through the case that you did before you came here?
Sure. The last case I did before coming here was an unruptured medium to small anterior communicating aneurysm in a 60-year-old woman with some risk factors. Smoker, not in fantastic shape. My fellow and I treated her with intrasaccular flow disruption with a web device. We spent some time trying to decide, you know, what to do in two phases. One, in the clinic, when we were making recommendations and talking to her about what she wanted to do. And then after she was asleep on the table and we had better 3D views and worried that the neck wouldn't be completely treated by a web, and maybe whether we should do a stent coiling. In the end, I think we were able to get a good occlusion of the aneurysm with a sub-millimeter neck remnant. And I think we've become a little bit aggressive about sub-millimeter neck remnants, and it's okay, in my opinion, with whatever strategy to leave small neck remnants.
So now the final question. What do you want to leave as your legacy in the field?
I think better equipped, better trained, better capable neurointerventionalists and neurosurgeons. I'm 52 and now recently chair of a department. I really enjoy watching young surgeons develop, become more capable, and enjoy the field. So I don't know that I can think of any better legacy. I used to send cases to older colleagues all the time to ask their advice. Dan Barrow at Emory was incredibly generous with his time for no good reason on giving me case advice. As I said, Kim Nelson, Alex Berenstein, lots of other people were much kinder to me than I ever deserved. And strangely now, I find myself on the other end of that, and I get a lot of text messages from ex-fellows or colleagues or friends asking what I would do with one thing or another thing. And in the internet age, it's so easy to ask for advice that I really think the next generation is going to be amazing. I examined candidates for the American Board of Neurological Surgery, the oral exam, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And there were a couple of candidates who just were incredible. You know, here you are, you're supposed to be testing their mettle and maybe challenging them. And I'm thinking, this person is already an unbelievable surgeon and seems to really have a great sense of what they can do and what their limitations are and how to learn from it. So I think looking for opportunities to help people to be better is a fun and rewarding thing to do. And it would be great if I can do that some more.
Dr. Arthur, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you very much, Nantia.